Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Savage Starlight, the officially unofficial podcast for The Last of Us on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we're back with another Season 1, Episode 7, Left Behind episode. This time, it's the feedback. Aaron, what do we got?
A bunch of stuff. We can be reached at TLOU@baldmove.com. That's what these intrepid individuals did. Get featured on the show. And here is a selection of the many, many responses we got this week. First off, Dork of the Ninja says, quick non-spoiler correction here, but in the podcast you said it was Neil Druckmann's daughter who did the cover of the song at the end of episode 106. In actuality, it's Craig Mazin's daughter, who's apparently a very talented singer in her own right. Damn it. I thought, sure, because every once in a while, it's not that even Neil and Craig sound similar.
No.
But I it's like there's two voices that are definitely not...
Troy Baker, or Nolan North.
Yeah, or Nolan North. There's two guys that are definitely not professional voice actors, and then there's a professional. And like sometimes I get him, but I thought sure that that was Druckmann, but yeah, it's Craig Mazin.
Okay.
So thanks for the correction. I'm issuing it here. Kristen says this might be part of the show creators' reasons for not including many assault weapons, but the ban on them for civilian sales in the States would still be in effect in 2003. Obviously, the military, like Federer, would have access to assault rifles, but they wouldn't be quite as prevalent in the West as they are today, since their sales and popularity really exploded sometime after the ban expired in 2004. So I had probably, I'm not even kidding you, 35 to 40 emails making sure I knew about the 1994 assault weapons ban. And I didn't, to be fair, I did not think about that in terms of timing. I am actually extremely aware of the 1994 assault weapons ban because it went into effect 2 weeks after I turned 18. And of course, living in Southern Indiana, I made sure in that time that I went out and bought a fucking assault weapon. As was my right as an American.
So did the ban just keep you from buying them, or did you have to like turn it into the authorities?
Dude, so okay, I'm going to, no, I'm going to get into that. First of all, it only, I think it only ever covered weapons were manufactured after the assault weapons ban went into effect.
So you just couldn't build them?
And what it banned in reality are guns that had... Well, there's two main things it banned. It banned magazine capacities in excess of 10 rounds. So a 30-round banana clips you couldn't buy in those 10 years.
And I assume banned, fully automatic weapons.
I think those were always banned. Those were banned earlier in like 1984, like 1984, 85. Somewhere in there, you could no longer buy automatic weapons without the appropriate ATF stamp, which are reasonably hard to get. Then the thing about the other thing they banned is semi-automatic rifles with more than two of the following characteristics. A bayonet lug, something you could fix a knife to the end of a gun. A folding stock, which I think also included a collapsible stock, a pistol grip, grenade launcher, flash suppressor, and a cut. Like you could have one of those features, but you couldn't have more than two of them. Or maybe I think that two or more.
All right, so take your pick. I want the grenade launcher.
So
I
think a lot of people's probably the people were pleased with the ban, thought that this would like take AR-15s off the street. That's not true. It just made, you know, the sale of really cool looking AR-15s illegal. So I don't know. Like the ammo capacity thing is definitely a huge factor in that. Like, you know, 10 rounds is a lot less than 30, certainly a lot less than like a 100-round drum clip. But yeah, I don't know. Like, that's definitely, I think, a reason the show could lean on. But like, again, with knowing a little bit more about the ban, I just don't know that it did that. Now, it is true that assault weapons popularity did really take off in the 21st century. I'm not sure if it's because the ban ended or just because there was a lot of successful, to me, kind of like scuttlebutt about constantly banning guns and banning ammunition and this and that, leading to people wanting to buy, you know, just like me, you know, like I probably wouldn't have bought an assault rifle when I turned 18, except for they were going to make them illegal and I'll be damned if I couldn't, you know? Mm-hmm. So like sometimes I don't know, I'm not fully convinced this is the reason. I think the main explanation is that these are in-game weapons that Joel does not have access to in the game, and this is kind of an elaborate in-universe joke about that, but that's just my two cents on the assault weapons ban. Alan says, you've been making the point that Joel seems like a stand-up guy, quote-unquote, but he's also been guilty of doing some of the same stuff that we've seen Raiders do. This really has started to gnaw at me. I feel like maybe the showrunners haven't really fully reckoned with this aspect of Joel's backstory. We don't know what exactly he did. Just steal stuff at gunpoint, like the elderly couple in the cabin, and then only kill them if people tried to fight back? Did he ruthlessly slaughter innocent, decent, nonviolent people without mercy? It's hard to imagine the latter, but it would be illuminating to show flashbacks of how these things played out. Is actually on the morally worse end of that spectrum, then I think we'd have to stop and consider whether we should be considering Joel a stand-up guy at all. I just think the show has put the thumb on its scale by showing Joel doing mostly decent things while telling us he has done worse but keeping the details vague. I really like the show overall, but this nags at me a bit.
I suppose, yeah. I guess until they show that to me, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. Although I do think they led us kind of down that path a little bit with the Tommy episode there in Jackson. Them sort of like, I guess having somebody else kind of judge him about the things that they did made it more real for me, because yeah, some, for sure, someone might look at their own actions and be like, God, I know exactly why I did that. I know what I did, and I really feel like shit for it. Somebody else saying, yeah, you should feel like shit for it makes it more real to me.
Yeah, this email made me think of like the well-attested fact that after World War II, there was that we were keen as a world to figure out kind of what went wrong in some of these societies where these unimaginable crimes were being not only contemplated but carried out with gusto. And there was a lot of world-leading psychologists that interviewed many, many Nazi war criminals, Japanese war criminals. And they were thinking that they would find some clear psychopathy, or there'd be some kind of like mental imbalance, or there'd be something peculiar in their mental makeups that would make them abnormal as human beings. And time and time again, study after study, interview after interview, they found that these people were all quite sane. And there's one of the researchers or one of the psychologists said that it was, if anything, like a social cultural disease, like a certain environment of a conformity of thought and deference to authority that combined to make people susceptible to, you know, this kind of like, moral flexibility. And in the absence of that, they were just, you know, it's not like they were sadistic parents or terrible husbands or otherwise, you know, they could be stand-up guys, but in the context of being in a death camp, they're war criminals, right? So I've always thought as like, you know, like I'm very uncomfortable thinking about people in terms of people being predisposed for good or evil. I feel like I said in the podcast, that everyone's probably capable of unspeakable shit, and people are probably capable of really touching acts of virtue. It's just what kind of systems and environments we put them in. And you think about a mushroom apocalypse where you have a fascist tied in the government trying to impose law and order. Like, what kind of moral flexibility would be required to live, and what type of people would be, you know, weeded out, you know, like the good,
it's a
the people that
selecting system,
the people that stop and help people on the road are going to be the first murdered by the raiders. Right. And then those people are going to be self-selected out of the society. So I don't know. This is, and it's a classic, you know, story of like a hero who had done terrible things as a villain and is trying to redeem themselves. Like, you know, I think people can change. I think when circumstances change, people can change. But it's an uncomfortable fact of humans. I think we're all capable of the best and worst at any time.
And I do get the impression that when Tommy's talking about the things they did, he's talking about a distant past, right? Not like, well, right before I left, we were murdering people for supplies.
Yes.
This was very close to post-outbreak in my mind. And so Joel has had 20 years to dwell on that, to think about that, and perhaps change who he is, you know, being in not as extreme circumstances. But that's just my headcanon. I actually don't know that for a fact.
Because, like, you know, how you operate in the wilds is probably different than how you'd act in a quarantine zone, which is definitely different than you're going to act in Jackson. So I think that that's all good stuff to keep in mind. But I think that you're honestly supposed to be thinking about this stuff, Alan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're supposed to, as you get new information, start thinking about, you know, well, what do we think of this person and why do we think of that? You know, why are we cutting this person slack and not cutting this other person slack? Why does this person deserve to die? Why does this person deserve to live? It's like those Rorschach tests administered to the to the Nazis. What does it all mean? Brenda said, hey, longtime listener to All Things Bald Move and first time caller. Well, welcome. This might be dry pie at this point, depending on the Tommy Joel storyline. But as a parent, why would Joel ever forgive Tommy for 2003? If Tommy hadn't gotten thrown in jail the night of the outbreak, Joel would have been home and maybe able to properly respond to Sarah in lockstep, which might have led to her being out of town and not being caught in the chaos and thus shot. I can't remember that the show has touched on this at all, and I may be getting geriatric and forgetting things, but I find it a major blocking point to their relationship, and it's weird how it has never come up. What do you think about the Joel-Tommy blame game here?
You might be right that Joel might be the kind of guy to blame something like that on circumstances that were out of his control, right? Like, he doesn't want to blame himself for it, but it seems like he does. That's the thing. Like, Joel has internalized this as his own failing. And, you know, barring that, maybe he would have blamed Tommy, but it definitely seems like he's not that kind of guy.
I think it'd be one thing if, like, Tommy was out there, got in a bar fight between, like, Texas and Texas A&M fans about which football team's better. But, like, Tommy got thrown in jail defending a woman from getting violently attacked by what is going to turn out to be an infected man.
Sure.
Like, sure. If you're playing this out of, like, why did you get your ass arrested? He's like, am I in the real world supposed to let this man eat this woman? Like, what the fuck, Joel? And I don't think, no matter what kind of pissed off state Joel would be in, that logic would fly with him. Again, it's not that Tommy hasn't been perhaps irresponsible or idealistic before. Mm-hmm. It's just that, like, yeah, I think Joel would agree with that moral calculus.
Yeah, I don't know what it is in his past that made him take all this blame, but he definitely has. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I mean, Joel feels like he is the one. And that's the other thing. Like, Joel feels like he's the one responsible and Tommy isn't.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another, like, that's a wild thing that happens in family dynamics. Like, if you have, like, a younger brother or sister who's just a fuck up in the family and people just have different expectations for them on their past behavior, it's like, what the fuck can they get? Well, that's because that's, you know, Tommy. And that can be a real thing. Like, oh, that's, you can look it up in the science books under Tommy. All right. They're just irresponsible, crazy people that occasionally get thrown into jail. And that's, like, baked into the situation. That could be a dimension, too. Ted Lasso, what a guy, emails in and said, shared with us a heartwarming article from the Washington Capitals, I guess. It turns out that Kevon Woodard, who you'll recall played Sam in the Sam Henry arc on The Last of Us, is a big fan of the Capitals. And they invited him a couple weeks back to visit them at their practice facility. And I did not know this, but apparently Kevon is a really good hockey player. He's a youth hockey player for the Bowie Bruins. He's a big fan of the Capitals, team superstar Alex Ovechkin, And he taught him how to sign his name. And he gave Woodard a signed hockey stick. And then Woodard actually scored a goal on the Caps goalie, which I guess impressed the team. There's video of this. I saw this going around Twitter a couple weeks ago, and it was... I'm always a sucker for, like, you know, the big tough athlete guys visiting this, you know, the 10-year-old kids and whatever, you know, whether it's Make-A-Wish or if it's just you know, delighting a 10-year-old fan. I'm a softy for that kind of stuff. So I thought that was cool.
Yeah.
And appreciate you sharing Ted last. So actually about five people shared that Ted was just up first. Stefan says, in Tuesday's episode, in the instant take, you're wondering about what non-game players might think about what Ellie was doing as she reached for the door. Well, as an Xbox gamer who could have not played the game, my virgin eyes told me that no way she was going to leave him. In fact, I was not even aware that we were supposed to think that that was going through her mind. From what I've seen, Ellie would rather take her chances with Joel than go back to Jackson alone. And how would she even get there? She's already told us she is dead without Joel. To me, the scene was more about showing how reliant Ellie is on him, how much she does not want to lose the only person she has left, and how the only way to endure and survive is to get Joel healthy again.
Yeah, you're right. We've seen it, right? We saw it in the Tommy Jackson episode. She does value whatever she has with Joel here extremely highly. So it's weird. It's almost strange to me that they play it as like a early episode cliffhanger where we're waiting all episode to figure out, is she actually going to leave him or not? Because they've kind of already told us the answer to that.
But they also showed that, like, I mean, obviously agree. I don't know if it's like I would quite put it up to the layer of like schmuck bait that, like, you know, do you really going to believe that? But the show also did establish that they had a peaceful 5-day journey. Mm-hmm. Pretty straightforward from Jackson at this point, which I think put a little bit more weight on the side of the scale that she might, like, you know, it'd be one thing if it was hell getting here, but like it was an easy 5 days of travel, according to her. Even without food, just with like a modest amount of water, she could probably, as long as she wasn't running from raiders and fungal infected, probably make it back, I would think.
Yeah, and if Joel's actually dying in this moment, then there's a lot of reason for her to just move on.
Yeah. Like I said, if he died, for sure. It'd be interesting to see... be interesting to see if he doesn't survive this procedure.
Uh-huh.
what Ellie will do for the rest of the series. But,
yeah.
Now's the time to endure and survive. We'll be back with more Savage Starlight.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
Just so we're clear about back there, it was either us or the ad. Welcome back to more Savage Starlight.
But anyway, I was, like I said, when I was playing the game, and maybe it's because I'm just super cautious and I'm always guarded, you know, like when I'm watching a scary movie, I'm always looking in the background for shit to jump, we talked about, but I'm always also looking for, you know, where they're going to surprise me with this, you know, and I always thought the Last of Us did feel like a franchise where one of them might not make it to the end, especially since it's called The Last of Us, right? I think even the title kind of implied that there is a winnowing being done. So David's up first, and we took a fair, or maybe I should say I took a fair amount of flack for my refusal to soften on the show and, you know, maintaining that it's kind of a filler episode. A lot of people struck back at that. David was first up, says, as a show only fan, I don't know how many of the details from the episode are game canon and how many are show only. But I think you might be taking your game player knowledge for granted and not appreciate how much we show-only fans learned about Ellie in this episode. We learned about her sexuality. We got a glimpse of her life, into the life of orphans being raised in Fedra school. Mostly, we learn what Ellie knows about loss. Last episode, Joel told Ellie she doesn't know anything about loss. Now we have a better understanding. It may not have been as traumatic as Joel losing his daughter, but a 14-year-old orphan being raised by the system, losing your roommate slash best friend slash love interest, is about as traumatic as I can imagine for a girl of her age. I just wish we could have seen more. I think what you said here about your game player knowledge for granted is certainly true, because I, of course, knew already that Ellie was gay, so that wasn't a revelation. And what I wanted to know more about, this, you know, the circumstances of Marlene and Ellie first meeting, how Marlene, you know, like, I didn't get any of that. So, like, there is a little bit of the kind of revelations that I guess new people are getting in the series seemed old hat to me. And the stuff I really wanted to get, I didn't.
Totally. I didn't even think about that stuff. Like, oh, wait, they actually haven't told us that Ellie's gay yet. At least they haven't come out and said it, obviously. And yeah, the stuff that, like, you are more interested in and I'm more interested in for sure is the stuff that is TV show, you know, original stuff, right? Like the Marlene stuff. I don't know anything about that. So of course I want more information about it, but you're right. I definitely think this is an episode that is kind of harmed by having all that in-game knowledge already.
Yeah.
And it's not completely, it doesn't completely destroy the episode. I still think it's very good, but definitely I was taking things for granted.
Yeah, we got, you know, there's a lot of emails where maybe a little bit more pointed about, you know, one, you know, because I joked about, like, oh, well, just, you know, the lives of young gay women just are inherently not as interesting as middle-aged gay men.
Jesus, a lot of people realize that was a joke.
I do, but, like, you know, I think because we heard a lot from young gay women in the feedback and couple people, I think, accused us, and I'll say rightfully, that our lack of melanin, our inherent cisness and straightness blinded us to some of the charms of this episode. And you got it. If you ever hear me say that I am not racist or sexist, then you will know that I've lost the plot and I'm lying. How the fuck could I come out of Mooresville, Indiana, with a base set of pretty faulty assumptions about the world? Best I can do is try to uncover as many as I can and correct them before I stop breathing. But I am not complete through that process. So you guys are right to assume that all that shit is coloring my view at all the time.
And being a gamer on top of that, forget about it.
Sure. Sure. The most oppressed class of citizen, of course.
Okay. Not my point, but yes. Sure.
Yeah.
I'll agree. 100%.
You wanted to capture a little bit of the marginalized viewpoint. I get it, Jim. But that's all true. I am not going to completely abandon my viewpoint of this episode. It is a little reductive, even in terms of if you don't know things like, you know, Ellie's backstory, it is a little bit redundant. And I think it does work better as a standalone experience to prolong, like I said, in a Christmas episode or something like that. But I do wish I hadn't been as little flippant about it, because I just didn't anticipate the fact like, oh, right, there's not that many times you get to see young gay women falling in love. You know, like as vanishingly small as a sample I can think of in terms of young gay men, which has really only been something I've seen in the last 10, 15 years in pop culture. I think there's even fewer accounts for that for women. So, yeah, I apologize if I made anyone feel attacked or invalidated about that. Wasn't my intention. And again, I don't think we're going to have a problem, because I think the rest of the season is going to be straight fire, and we're all going to be singing from the same hymn book going forward. Let's see. Liz, a few other points. I do think one important thing this episode does is further reinforce Ellie's general sense of self-discovery in the post-apocalyptic world. And this episode is mostly romantic discovery, but it's also the penultimate questions of who do I want to be when I grow up? What do I want to be when I grow up? What does grown up look like in Boston with Riley versus Kansas City with Henry versus Jackson with whoever? Ellie wants someone to look up to. She gravitates towards Jess, then to Joel. At first, we saw it was Kwong. Hence, my question, is this man indoctrinating her? Ellie isn't looking for a parent. She's looking for a model for adulthood. I took his vibe as both genuine and more as a coach or a mentor, not a propagandist. I'm sure the culture at Fedra and Fedra-run QZs have all kinds of propaganda, but the interpersonal relation of Kwong to Ellie belies a genuine sense of seeing raw potential in someone to be more than they see in themselves. In another world, I could see Kwong making the exact same type of appeals as a guidance counselor or a teacher to a student has potential but lacks self-confidence and otherwise without the collective motivation of propagandizing a social political view.
Yeah, the motivation might not be there, but I think there's inherent propaganda in Kwong in his worldview, right? Like, he doesn't suggest, hey, you could grow up and do whatever you want. He's trying to push her down the only two paths that he sees for her, which just so happen to both be inside the Fedra organization with Fedra on top. So there's inherent propaganda in that. But you're right. I do think he's genuinely trying to do right by this girl. It's just he has a very limited worldview.
Yeah, it's like, well,
maybe
he might
fair
even say
reason too.
Sure, and he might say that Fedra isn't a perfect organization, but in his view, it's Fedra or a complete lawless collapse. So if you can only see Fedra as being the alternative to chaos and murder and starvation, then it's automatically going to be good, right?
Of course,
You know, like, I wonder if Kwong would see a report about something like Jackson. Like, what would he think? Would he think it's like, that's Firefly propaganda? The fact that people like a couple hundred people are just making it work out there without hangings and executions.
Probably like, oh, that's going to fall apart in days. What happens when pirates come? Well, what happens when, you know, when we roll in, you know?
Or it could be simple, like maybe Fedra's mandate, they cannot be picky about who they let in the quarantine zone. Like, they don't get to summarily execute anyone that doesn't pass the vibe test.
True.
Although in practice, I imagine Fedra executes plenty of people for not passing the vibe check.
Oh, yeah. They just come up with other reasons officially.
Right. Darsh says, I'm a game player when it first came out, so it's a very distant and fuzzy on details, as well as a show watcher. And I'm not sure if it's a change for the show, but wow, there's a really subtle point that makes this episode particularly dark. For saving Joel in Kansas City, Ellie indicates it wasn't her first time killing someone. The setup and execution of this episode clearly implies Riley was, in fact, her first kill. Hell of a way to get shot down on her first date. Cheers. So one thing that I thought I recalled from the DLC, and I was confirmed by many, many people emailing it to me, is that the DLC similarly does not reveal what happens after this moment.
Huh. Okay.
We don't get to see exactly how Riley's turn went down. So it's something we can all engage in speculation. What do you think? Because
she had to kill Riley? I assume probably yes. But it's hard to imagine that that's the first kill either, because she does kill this infected here. How long does she wait to kill Riley? Because I assume she doesn't kill Riley until she's turned. I mean, given Riley's stance on them killing themselves.
Yeah, I think she was fully expecting her to turn as well. So it probably came to a shock when that just didn't happen.
Right. So do you count that as the first kill?
Well, yeah.
She's still personally.
Yeah.
Ellie probably still sees her as Riley when she has to kill her is the troubling thing. So, yeah, she probably sees it that way.
I think The Walking Dead has a useful distinction where you do have to distinguish when you're talking about killing. Are you talking zombies? Or are you talking people? Because I do think it would probably, I mean, I'm sure in early goings, it would be traumatic to kill a recently dead zombie. But if you're talking about a shambling corpse, it's essentially a skeleton, you know, I would think that that would not feel like killing a person. That would very much feel like killing a monster. And thus not be as psychologically traumatizing. So, like, I think it's a useful distinction. But Ellie, I think, I don't know, from the gas station experience, I think she sees killing the fungus people as still killing some kind of person.
Yes, I would agree with that.
And if we're talking about an infected, I don't know. Because things could, like a lot of things could have shown up. Like it could have been that Marlene shows up and neither of them have turned yet. And
sure,
you know, it could be that Marlene shows up and Ellie's standing dead or alive over a dead Riley. It could be, it could be that they get there and Riley turns while the Fireflies are there. I mean, I don't know. I guess I don't have a headcanon for that.
Yeah, I don't either, which is kind of why I wanted to see it.
Michael T says, not sure why, if the infected was hooked into the Tendril network, it didn't bring a bunch of infected to the mall. It would have been a much more exciting ending, which is, for me, something the episode really needed.
Get the impression, like we kind of mentioned in the last podcast, that it was sort of its own network at that moment. Hadn't connected up with the Fuller network yet.
I do think they are flirting with the idea that this their Tendril thing might not be taken seriously, because like you have to kind of headcanon and think, like, because you think about how, like, and that's something they know about, because they wax poetic about it in the second episode. It's like how many miles these mushroom networks can extend, and you're talking about underground places they can spread through. You know, cracks in cement, and they can exploit all these natural gaps. And it's like really hard for me to believe that in the Boston quarantine zone, a lone zombie body with that much growth around it wouldn't have found a way to connect to a larger network.
Yeah. Are they trying to lampshade it when they say this thing's of like a bunker? Are they trying to say like it couldn't actually get out?
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know how many bunkers have giant skylights in them, but it's entirely possible to Joe Rogan it. It's entirely possible. I do think that they do need to be careful, because they've kind of trapped themselves with there's awesome mechanic, but if it's trapped, you have to believe that every infected within an X square or whatever is going to just converge on that spot. And if they did that in this episode, being the Boston quarantine zone and a major urban I mean, we saw how many fuckers it brought just a few weeks later, right?
Yeah.
So presumably all those people, and like, how the hell are these two girls going to fight those off with a revolver?
They're not.
Well, I don't think it's a revolver. Even you got 20 shots in that pistol, you're going to die. There's just no way. And I do think, they need to be, you know, especially next season, they need to really think about that stuff and make sure they're not setting themselves up for it's not a failure, but like shaking people's suspension of disbelief. you know, because you can only jostle them so many times before the whole shit collapses. Alex B. from Ohio. In the instant talk, you guys compared episode 3 and episode 7. I wonder if maybe those comparisons were intentional. Their third episode was a flashback showing an LGBT relationship forming that has a lot of similar beats. One person takes a chance and kisses the other without knowing for sure the feelings will be reciprocated. The endings where they decide to die in each other's arms mirrored each other as well. But the question is, did Riley get what Bill would have called the tragic suicide ending? Or by deciding not to kill themselves, did they avoid that? After all, this decision allowed Ellie to live and presumably get another chance at love. I guess in sum, would this episode have hit differently if we didn't have episode 3? Did Bill and Frank fly so that Riley could die? It is an interesting juxtaposition.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they're doing with it, though.
Because you're also, you could, you, the other thing is, like, you could flirt with the kind of gauche trope of the doomed gay romance, right? You know, that's what Bill's talking about. This isn't a tragic last act suicide. You know, this is me dying full and happy. Well, this
is much like more that
Ellie and Riley would be clearly more in that, you know, that mold. But it's subverted because she's magically immune to the transformation process.
Mm-hmm.
Not magically, scientifically.
Yeah, which I don't know. I'm not certain. I need to think about this one more, because I'm certain it was intentional, right? You don't sit down and write these two very similar episodes.
Oh, especially in
without
this
understanding
series,
what you're doing.
Doing tons of those comparisons, like those pairings, and you know what's different, what's the same, contrasting. Yeah, no, I think they're definitely going for something there. Liz would also like to offer perspective on the importance of the episode. Until this point, we've really only seen Ellie in relation to Joel. Very little has been said or shown about her background. The character building we've seen had with Joel has been much more significant. He's had relationships with Sarah, Tommy, Tess, the Federal agent he killed, Bill and Frank. All these have helped us understand who Joel is and why he does the things he does. In contrast, we've only really met Ellie shortly before she was handed over to Joel, and since then, all our interactions have been in conjunction with him. Far too often with female, queer, BIPOC characters, they are thinly written. They're often depicted in stereotypical or basic ways. I'm grateful the showrunners deemed Ellie important enough to give more depth. By the way, BIPOC, if you're not familiar, refers to Black Indigenous people of color. Was the episode necessary in pushing the plot forward and demonstrating the bond between Joel and Ellie? Was it necessary to have the opening to the show where Joel loses Sarah? That experience and its impact could have been told in another way. Perhaps a conversation between Joel and Tess in the first episode. There's hundreds of cues that tell us how terrible the fall was and how grim current life is. Joel's level of loss is not hard to imagine, especially since he is like us, he's led a pre-apocalypse life. But the way it's shown is so much better and connects the audience to Joel on a deeper level. Ellie's much more of an enigma. As y'all have said, she's only known this world. Understanding that Ellie was almost left behind by Riley, and she's not only lost her first love because of infection, but the harrowing thought of Ellie not turning while Riley does, and the most likely outcome that Ellie had to kill her, I believe is essential to the plot of the story. I found myself thinking about some of her past scenes, knowing what happens with Riley. How does that change her thoughts on who or what she was doing with the infected boy trapped in the basement of the convenience store? Her relationship with Sam and Henry also take on new meaning. Her attempts to save Sam and devastation of his death is seen in a different light. She's clearly someone who, when she bonds hard, even if she tries to pretend otherwise, which contrasts starkly with Joel. Joel has been living to merely survive. Ellie has been, in contrast, searching for a life, a search for family and friends and community. To see these two grasp hands and perhaps find in each other what they've been missing is that much more impactful, knowing the roads that led them both there. Fair enough.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm always welcoming of these kind of flashback episodes, because I think for me it's more affecting to see something actually happen than to have a conversation about it and imagine it. So yeah, I mean, this sheds a lot more light on Ellie. I do wonder, because early in the season they talked about, I think this was when Joel killed the Fedra guy on their way out of the Boston QZ. They talked about how Ellie responded to that, in their like post episode discussions and the podcast, and they were basically saying the fundamental difference here is that Sarah was kind of horrified by how Joel reacted and when he killed this woman, right? This old lady, and how Ellie reacted, where she was kind of curious and interested and kind of excited by it. And looking back at it, I'm not sure exactly what they're getting at, but maybe there's more of a like, this could be my protector here, instead of like, she's got some morbid curiosity about this. And but then I look at the scene where she's cutting up the infected in the basement of that gas station, and I'm a little bit puzzled by that. I don't know if she's trying to figure out, like, did I actually kill something that I could consider Riley, or did I kill something that I would think is just an infected monster, right?
Knowing what we know now, it seems like that's what she was trying to determine, you know?
But
like,
we don't even know if she killed Riley yet, necessarily. Right. So, like, are they going to piece those? Are they going to put those pieces together? Because this is what I'm saying. I wish we had seen the aftermath of this, like the actual conclusion of this scene, because I would know so much more about it. I'd be able to say things confidently instead of like, well, if she killed Riley, then maybe she was trying to figure out whether she killed Riley or a monster, you know?
But I think it's fun to kind of surmise that stuff and then to extrapolate based on what we do know.
But
it's I think that this point about like that this episode did give us a chance to see Ellie outside of the lens of Joel, and how like maybe I didn't think of that perspective, because playing the game, you know, to this point, like, Joel's literally your point of view.
Uh-huh.
He is not, it's not like Joel and Joel is the main character. Ellie is a pain in the ass you acquire and you kind of take a shine to over the course of your travels. So like, getting to know her that obliquely felt natural, and I didn't feel like there's anything missing. But like, yeah, from this perspective, you know, I think the show feels much more like this is the two, it's Joel and Ellie. They're the leads.
Yeah.
And it probably feels weird from not that game perspective, where your POV is unambiguously Joel's, to like have so much information about Joel and his inner thoughts and how he's feeling and so little about Ellie. So, like I said, fair point. Torbjorn from the Arctic Norway. The Arctic. Like, I thought that was all of Norway. There's an Arctic Norway?
Yeah. There's beautiful, sandy, sunny beaches on the south, and then it's Arctic tundra.
Right, it's essentially L.A. South Norway's L.A. Arctic Norway. Fucking put on your long underwear. Get ready. Torbjorn says, I love The Last of Us, being a PC person, thus not having played the game. Oh, here's something for non-gamers. The real kick in the pants about The Last of Us is it's been a PlayStation exclusive. I think still, maybe it's coming out on PC soon.
I want to say it might be out now on PC, if not very soon.
It's not just been about like, do you want to play the game? It's, do you want to play the game? Do you have the equipment to play it? Are you willing to sink $600 into the things you need to play the game? So even amongst gamers, this is not a ubiquitous experience, you know? Yeah. Anyway, being a PC person, he hasn't played the game. And three of my podcast highlights every week are Savage Starlight, Instant Main, and Feedback episodes. That's high praise. Thank you. You guys mentioned the Take On Me song by A-ha when they flee from the mall, flee for the mall fun time. There may be some cross-referencing here to the music video that came out in the 1986 for this song. From the synopsis from the wiki, the video's main theme is a romantic fantasy narrative. A young woman is reading a comic book. As the woman reads, the comic's hero, after winning a motorcycle race, seemingly winks at the woman from the page. His pencil-drawn hand suddenly reaches out of the comic book, inviting the woman into it. Once inside, she too appears to be pencil-drawn form as he sings to her and introduces her to his black-and-white world that features a sort of looking-glass portal where people and objects look real on one side and pencil-drawn on the other. At the end, the young man escapes from the comic book by becoming human and stands up, smiling. The woman runs toward him. I find it interesting that Ellie reads a comic book and then suddenly someone romantically linked bursts into her black-and-white/gray world to take her into a colorful world of wonder and fun. Quite an innocent romance to the music of Take On Me by A-ha, thus giving all us Norwegians growing up in the 80s a lot of beautiful nostalgia. Nice. I think this is a valid this is a valid interpretation.
Sure, I can see some similarities here.
I did not know that Aha was a Norwegian. I did not know that they were Swedish in origin. So good for you guys. Good for you, Arctic Norwegians.
I do also want to point out Last of Us Part 1 was scheduled to come out on PC tomorrow, actually, March 3rd. It got pushed back a few weeks, which I feel like is unfortunate because...
Suck it, PC players.
Yeah, so it's now March 28th, which is going to be after the show ends.
They're saving you from yourselves because they know. True. They know you'd be halfway. You'd be on the penultimate episode and you'd binge the game and ruin it for yourself. And
yeah.
What are you going to do?
So very soon, PC players can also get in on this.
So surely by the summer of 2024, it'll be out.
Yeah.
I know how these video game release cycles go. Zach says, Riley said that if she asked Marlene to let Ellie come with her to the Atlantic Oak QZ and that Marlene said no. We also know that in the pilot, Marlene told Ellie that she knew Ellie's mom and Marlene was the only one who put Ellie or was the one who put Ellie in Fedra school.
Mm-hmm.
The face value read of Riley saying Marlene denied the request would be Marlene doesn't know who Ellie is and doesn't want to take any risks with unknown entities with Riley's mission. Is it possible that based on what we know from the pilot, Marlene knows exactly who Ellie is and wants to keep her safe and innocent at the federal school instead? That Marlene doesn't want Ellie exposed to the inherent risks of being out in the world, especially as a Firefly, which would make her a Fedra target and extra vulnerable while traveling from Boston to Atlanta as part of the planned Firefly mission? If true, it implies that Marlene already knows there's something special about Ellie that's worth protecting. Is it possible that even though we seem to be told that this is the first time Ellie's actually bitten, that it's not the first time she's exposed to an infection? I keep going back to that line that Marlene had in the first episode where she says she knew Ellie's mom. I can't help but wonder if Ellie's mom was a Firefly who was bitten while pregnant and potentially even bitten while giving birth to Ellie. The fact that baby Ellie wasn't turned told Marlene all she needed to know, and Ellie's life has been about protecting her immunity until the right time from the very beginning. Marlene would then decide to hide Ellie in a QZ where she would be safer under the protection of Fedra, who would then treat her as one of their own and protect her better than a ragtag group of Fireflies ever could. Okay. What do you think of this theory?
I'm inclined to disagree with it. Just because of my general nature, I like disagreeing with people. No, I don't see waiting until she's 14. What about this makes it the right time? I guess we don't have enough information to say yes or no for sure.
Right. You know, like the mall incident kind of would force Marlene's hand in this. Presumably she doesn't know that she's sneaking out with.
Yeah. My thing is, though, how organized have the Fireflies been and for how long? Because they clearly have some kind of capacity for scientific research, as we saw at the school, right? They've raided the school for its supplies and stuff.
They have a truly national reach. It seems like there's Fireflies at least as far as the East Coast or the Rocky Mountains.
Yes, and Marlene believes that they can do something with Ellie's immunity. When did that become true? Has she always believed that? And if not, what changed, I guess, recently? Because in my mind, you don't wait 14 years to figure out, you know, to find the perfect time to do something with this girl and leave her in the custody of somebody else, someone who is your enemy. In the meantime, what you would do is get her as far away from a Fedra QZ as possible, get her in the care of the Fireflies, get them looking at her and researching her and poking and prodding her as soon as possible. Not wait for some sort of perfect circumstance to emerge, but it may not have been possible. I don't know. Like, this is why I say I can't say for sure, because maybe they didn't have these research capabilities a year ago, right?
What if we made one change? Because he's like, okay, because I like the idea that Ellie's mom was pregnant with Ellie, got bit by infected, but that'd be like split set. Like, so they have to induce birth or do a cesarean to save the baby. But like, then Marlene wouldn't assume that, well, Ellie would be immune. It's just something that she has.
If the mom died to the bite? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You wouldn't be like, oh my God, this is a blade baby. It's got all the strengths. It's a daywalker. It's got all the strengths of the fungus and none of its meat needed. I don't think that that's necessarily where your mind would go. But it's probably something she has in the back of her mind. And then when she finds Ellie, who's been bitten, and she's like, let's wait and see where this thing goes, and then hatches the plan. Like, if you take out the intentionality of Marlene, like, ah, this is my test tube. Because, like, if that's the case, no offense, as ruthless as the Fireflies have been, I don't know why they wouldn't test that on the baby. Like, if we think this is immune, sure, it's not that life is precious in this world.
Yeah.
Like, let's do a controlled bite and see if this baby lives. Like, yeah, why would you wait for her to discover? Now, I also think that there is might be an element of Marlene. So, like, what if Marlene, because like Marlene just wants to protect Ellie for her own purposes. Mm-hmm. Maybe she wants
Friends
Fedder
with
to
their
train
mother,
him.
Whatever.
Yeah, because she knows Fedder is the best protection. Maybe she knows that Fedder will do a bang up job teaching like basic skill set to Ellie, and then they can kidnap her at some point and use her for their own purposes. But like, I think there's also a dark possibility that Marlene manipulated events behind the scenes to reassign Riley to someplace far, far away where she will not corrupt Ellie into sneaking out at night and doing dangerous shit. I think it's telling that Marlene found Riley, and the story is she observed her sneaking around. I don't know, man. Sounds like maybe she was targeted and like, oh, you seem pretty cool. You're gonna go, like, let's get you as far away from Ellie as possible so you can't, you know, you can't fuck up my protection strategy here.
That's possible. Yeah, man, we just don't have enough info.
Yeah, but it's what's funny because we get to speculate, right? This is the one thing where we can like, sure, what the fuck?
Totally, yeah. I think it'd be it's a cool idea, kind of to run with something you mentioned, leaving Ellie in Fedra's care to get training. It's kind of a cool idea that the Fireflies would use Fedra's resources to train their own people, right? Like you get them inside of Fedra, you get them like resentful of the conditions there, and then you go, you know, swoop in, you know, take back your assets after they've been
basic gun training with their ammo and their equipment, and they're going to feed and they're going to provide physical therapy.
It's a long-term play, but I think it's kind of smart.
You have to bet on your ability to unindoctrinate the child rapidly. But I think the Fireflies would think that Fedra being so awful makes that job pretty easy.
Right.
But the only blind spot in that is Fireflies are kind of terrible, too, from these kids' perspectives. They're killing random innocent people, causing so
it's a risky play because, like, giving adults access to children's minds allows them a lot of liberties to take with those children. And I think
no problems. There's absolutely no problems doing that.
No problems. And I think it might be hard to deprogram them in short order. So maybe it's not worth it. Maybe it's easier to train a kid how to use a rifle than it is to deprogram them from a bunch of Fedra propaganda.
I cut a bit
but
of
it's
this
a cool
email
idea.
Out. Yeah, Zach's want to know if they need to show this on screen. If we want this to be canon, yes,
totally.
Like, if not, then you know, because like all this is wild spec. Let's be real. This is all wild speculation.
Uh-huh. Or just have a couple lines that state it. And it'll be canon. They don't have to necessarily show it, but yeah, definitely.
Jerry talked about us saying that there's no way that Ellie drugged Joel to the cabin. He disagrees. Says the official podcast touches on this and says the show opens from the perspective of Joel being dragged. You can see the drag marks tinged with blood leading all the way to the house. I assume Joel mustered enough strength to get downstairs.
Oh, I assume she tied him to the horse and just dragged his ass.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I think, yes, she drug him the last little bit from, you know, the driveway to the house. But, like, we were talking about, like, Indiana Jones style drug from a horse.
Uh-huh.
Like, which is, I think that's a lot more traumatic to be drugged by a horse than by a 14-year-old girl for 100 yards or so. But
true.
I do think it's a very funny possibility that she just did drag him.
Probably not at full gallop. She's probably not trying to take limbs off. I assume she's doing it carefully, but yeah, probably from the horse. It just makes the most sense. Put a blanket under him. He'll be fine.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe you could form a litter like that. Because I'm just thinking, like, what is the safe transport speed behind a horse when you have a gut wound? Like,
zero.
1 mile an hour, right. 2 mile an hour? Oh, I guess we're rough at 5 mile an hour. But then at 10, it kind of smooths out because the bumps hit fast enough that you just kind of skim over them. Yeah. And then 20, it's like a dream.
Like a BMX racer, right? You know, over those humps, you got to, like, hit that perfect speed.
Yeah, suspension just evens everything out.
Mm-hmm.
Anthony says, I didn't realize until this very episode that Ellie was from the Boston quarantine zone this entire time. I guess I didn't think about it much beforehand. My question, therefore, is, what is the population of quarantine zones, specifically the Boston one? Based on population numbers, do you find it odd that Joel and Ellie had never met or crossed paths during their time in the Boston QZ until Marlene introduced them? Ellie had to have spent much, if not in her entire 14-year-old life there, and Joel could have been there close to 20 years. I don't think Joel's been there for 20 years. I think Joel did about 5 years of, you know, reaving through the wastelands until they decided as a group to try for the quarantine zone. But yeah, if we go with Zach's theory, she's been there 14 years, clearly sometime to where she doesn't remember Marlene or her mother. So probably at least 10 years. Do you buy that the Boston quarantine zone is big enough that Joel would not cross paths with Ellie?
I could have sworn there was a population number mentioned about Kansas City. Am I wrong about that?
Mm.
Like, did they say there were 50,000? Or am I thinking, I'm thinking of Walking Dead, aren't I? With the Commonwealth.
The Commonwealth, yeah.
Boy, mixing up my apocalypses here. I guess I would imagine it's big enough.
Yeah, especially think about, like, even if you live in a small town, like, what does it mean to meet someone or run into somebody? Because I run, like, in my, I had a small town, I grew up in a small town of under 10,000, I think it was under 5,000.
Mm-hmm.
You run in a lot of people, but it's not like when I was in the supermarket, I'm like, oh, that's that dude, or that's that dude. It's
right.
Like, if I meet a person and be like, hey, my name, or if I see someone, you know, you have to see them many, many, many times, and, like, how often do those girls in federal school get out? It seems like they're kind of locked in that place. You know, they're in like a boarding school. Like, you don't just get to go out whenever you want. And
yeah, not going on grocery runs,
doing a whole bunch of gray market shit and burning corpses and stuff. I buy that they wouldn't have a lot of bumping in. And like, if I imagine easily you got 5-10,000 people there.
Yeah, they don't run in the same circles, for sure.
I wouldn't think so. Watch out for that fungus. We'll be right back with more Savage Starlight.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what 2-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
We found something to fight for. This podcast. Welcome back to Savage Starlight.
Scott says, hey guys, quick comment on the mall skylights. Being from Boston, I recognized immediately as Cambridge Side Galleria Mall, which is near the quarantine zone area in Boston. Not sure if that's the mall it's based on, but the Cambridge Side has a vaulted open skylight ceiling, though no arcade or carousel. Yeah, you provided a picture of this. This is, I mean, it looks exactly like what they're going for. Yeah, it's 100%. And that's the thing about The Last of Us. They tried very hard to match, like when you go through a location in the game, they do try to model it on the specific areas of the town or city that they're trying to model. So that's a cool touch. That shows, it's like, okay, you can either have those open skylights or you can have no one noticing that the teenagers are playing in the mall. You can't have them both, but you know, I don't know, maybe they did stuff slightly different in the video game that they had a different explanation for why, but it seems to me that anyone looking in this quadrant of the city would have to notice that there's all these lights going on, you know.
Yeah, I think so.
Luke says, I was rewatching episode one of the show and the introductory scenes to Boston. There's a quick scene that depicts a couple of guys who have lost limbs. Do you think this is a disciplinary thing for, like, stealing? Or is it possible that when caught early enough, amputation could help stop the spread of infection?
I assume it could. Yeah. Why not? If it's like, bite, oh, you're bit, chop, your arm's gone. Definitely. I think it could.
Yeah. The blood, how long does it take the blood to fully circulate in the body? Isn't it like less than a minute? I feel like blood from your toe gets back to your heart within a remarkably short period of time, with how little blood you have and the pulse rate. And, I thought it was something like under 60 seconds. So now some things travel along like neural pathways and not, and can take very, very, very slow. Some things don't travel. Like, you know, obviously if you get bit and you don't hit a vein or an artery, that's going to make something different. But I will say this, can't think of a single instance in the game where they do this.
Sure. Yeah. It's not like The Walking Dead in that way.
Yeah. Where you have several canon examples of, oh, if you got bit in the hand, chop, whip off that arm and you're going to be fine. So it might, I don't know, maybe those fungal spores just travel through the blood system so fast that it's impractical.
Yeah, I would believe that. If it's under a minute, honestly, if it's under a few minutes, I'd believe that it's just not, it would certainly be possible, but not likely, and they don't view it as an option.
It also seems like even in a hellhole like Fedra, like maiming people just seems like a bad idea. Like, it makes them less able to work. and sure. makes them
can't carry
more
corpses with one arm. Eh, maybe sure. child corpses.
You got to use the buddy system. Yeah. I don't know. The other thing is, like, we've seen from the show that it could be different. Like, we might get a scene of somebody whipping off someone's arm to save it or something. Or they might even be suggesting that in that scene. So,
I want to jump back to the previous email real quick where we talked about the lights in the mall. I wonder, and I don't know that we're going to get to see this, but I wonder if that is not what attracts the Fireflies to this location to then find Riley and Ellie.
You think they'd be keeping a closer eye on it since that's their, like, depot.
Right. So they see, somebody's in there. Like, Riley, what the fuck are you doing? Don't turn the lights on in the mall. And so they go over there and they find this situation. And then they're like, we got to get out of here before Fedra comes. That could be a likely scenario.
Yeah, for sure. Although, it's like I said, it's in a neighborhood that Fedra just recently electrified. I figured that there would be, like, workers... You know, like, it was like they just recently turned them on, but they haven't moved people in. Sure, there'd be people. Yeah.
You going to work at night, Aaron? I'm not working at night.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, everybody just goes. Everyone just like, it's a zombie apocalypse. Just go to sleep at night. There's no 24 hour nothing.
No guards at night.
Wait till tomorrow. Mañana. Michelle from Texas, who notes in her signature she's an oatmeal raisin cookie enthusiast. So large grains of salt for all opinions given in this here. This year feedback. This may have been pointed out already, but I was thinking about Riley's distaste for the Fedra future that was in front of her. But would she really have been any better off with the Fireflies? She mentions they're shipping her to a post in Atlanta, and from what we know in episode one, Atlanta is known for drugs and ammo. Based on her explanation for how Marlene noticed her sneaking around successfully, is it possible that we are just going to use Riley as a drug mule or gun runner? While standing guard sniffing shit isn't anyone's dream, I imagine it's much safer than what seems like she might be recruited for by the opposition. I'd love to hear y'all's thoughts on this.
I mean, I don't think there are any good options in this world. Right?
But I would think that, like, the revolutionary, ragtag revolutionary group would be more dangerous than the working for the fascist police state.
Potentially, yeah. Depends on how well-equipped and dangerous the... rebels are.
Well, and then you got KC where it's like, it's you know, you're just going to get just killed to every man and woman on the force. Yeah,
like I said, I don't think there are any great options. I guess, like, being a Fedra officer is probably the best you could hope for if you get to set your own schedule and sit in a cushy office all day, but yeah, it's all pretty dangerous. So no, I don't think she would have been much better off with the Fireflies.
Yeah, and that's a great way to get disillusioned about whatever, you know, egalitarian pipe dream organization that you think is perfect is to join them. Join them, volunteer for them, work with them on a project, and you will find out that, oh my God, this is staffed entirely by people.
And people are idiots.
Deeply imperfect and have mutually contradictory goals and desires and levels of power madness and whatnot. It's so, yeah, I imagine there's a lot of people join up the Fireflies thinking, ah, finally, something worth fighting for. And then they're essentially a drug running middleman. And, like, you know, just to keep the beast fed, just to keep the Firefly machine profitable and supplied, you know.
Mm-hmm. A lot of compromises that I'm sure are made on all sides.
All right. This is the last email before we get to the spore lore. So I want to give everybody a heads up so you can hit the pause or stop button when we get to the end of this. Gavin is going to be our gateway to the spore lore. He says, I know that the infected go through several different stages of development. However, what are the transitions between those different stages? Is there a distinct cutoff point where a runner becomes a clicker and then becomes a shambler, for example? Or is it more of a smooth, continuous process of development from runner all the way up to bloater? At what point do runners lose their eyesight and have to start using clicking noises to navigate the world? Or perhaps the infected do not all follow the same path of development, but can branch off and become different types of infected depending on their environmental circumstances. Good old-fashioned fungus biology. Fake biology. What do you think, Jim?
I think there's definitely a continuum here. And it would be like trying to pin down, you know, where Homo sapiens starts exactly, right? Like the missing link. Everybody's searching for the missing link. What's the missing link between the clicker and the runner? There's certainly a point, but it's probably different for every single infected because some of them are stronger, some of them are weaker, some of them, probably is affected by environment a little bit. But yeah, I don't think there's... I mean, obviously, when you become a clicker is when you lose your eyes and you start clicking, right? Like, you can start receiving those signals. But there's probably an in-between where it's like, well, it's got some eyesight, but it also has the clicking. Neither of these are particularly well-honed at this point because it's an in-between phase. But they're gradually... The eyesight's getting worse and the clicking sense is getting better. I don't know.
Yeah, and you know, since this is all based on a game, in a game you don't usually have in-between enemy types. Like, you don't ever find a runner that's, like, half a clicker or a clicker that's, like, half on its way to becoming a bloater or whatever. You know, it's always just, like, that's a clicker or that's a runner or that. Mm-hmm. I feel like the show has done a little bit more. Like, I thought that this, if you want to call him a runner, was decidedly clicker in its, like, head formations. And even some of the shrooms it was growing, like, started to grow armor on its shoulder. The convenience store, runner who was blind in one eye was already starting to make clicker noises. So it suggests that maybe they start clicking before they completely lose their eyesight.
That makes some sense. Yeah.
Also, like, we talk about how this isn't, I don't think, a precise process. So it could be that runners do not get the correct orientation of headgear and clicking upgrades, like, starve to death because they become blind and the clicker never quite came together. It didn't function correctly, and they starve and can't provide for themselves and get killed. So we only see the successful transition forms. We don't see the mutations that don't make it. Again, this is all, like, sci-fi evolution. This obviously couldn't take place. And someone sent me a long email saying, like, trying to get behind the science, it's like, it's one thing for the cordyceps, the mushroom, to jump the humans and maybe cause mental confusion or super aggression or something, but, like, building whole new structures and making echolocation and things like that, that's a lot of fucking macro evolution in just a few years' time. So, like, this is all very, even though it's got that science veneer and sheen to it, this is very much science fiction.
Yeah, I do want to say, I assume that all infected eventually starve to death. That's because I don't think what they're doing when they attack humans is looking for sustenance. I think they're trying to spread the parasite
to a new fresher
host, right? So that it can live on. But I assume, like, the parasite just eats and eats and eats and eats the body until there's
replacing
nothing left to
it
eat
with
and
mushroom
then
material
dies.
And yeah, and as right. And that's the thing, it's like, as it's replaced with mushroom, does it require less and less sustenance that it can't just derive from tendrils? And
maybe, you know, or if again, it connects up to the general network, it's probably gonna, you know, survive
right
a lot longer, because, you know, it's a fungus at the end of the day. It's able to derive its nutrients from a lot of different sources, probably not just humans, right? So
Yeah,
that's my assumption, is they all starve to death eventually.
It seems like that's borne out, like, when Joel sees that desiccated husk of the, like, fully illuminated, you know, runner up against the wall that's, like, completely blossom, and he's like, oh, yeah, it's all dried out. Like, I think that's what, yeah, like, when it can no longer do anything with its host, it just kind of, like, uses it up and turns it into fruiting bodies and tendrils and stuff.
Yeah.
All right, that's going to do it for our non-spoiler section of the feedback episode. If you want to follow us into the Spoilore, you're free to do so, but we will be discussing significant spoilers from the video games. And then if you we eventually get to the Super Spoilore, where we talk about The Last of Us 2. So be forearmed or forewarned and forearmed. TLOU at baldmove.com is how you send us feedback. Support.baldmove.com is how you find out about how to join the club and other ways that you can support us monetarily, because we do depend quite a bit on direct listener support to make these podcasts happen. Of course, you get access to ad-free feeds and tons of bonus audio content, like our Instant Take, Instant Talk live recordings on Sunday night. Not only do you get both sides of that instant podcast, but you get to participate. You get to watch us record live and participate with us using the YouTube chat system. Support.baldmove.com if you'd like to join in the Bald Move community. Finally, twitter.com/baldmove is where you find all of our other releases. Man, we're doing stuff all of the time. We're always reviewing movies. We just got done with Creed 3 last night. Going to be doing John Wick 4 at the end of the month. Starting Yellow Jackets. We're in the middle of Picard. We're doing The Mandalorian starting this week. Severance is coming up later. Foundation is coming up later. All the time we're doing stuff at Bald Move. Baldmove.com. You can follow that us at Twitter. That's it. Here on out, spoilers. Get out of here. Go. Run. The infected are coming. Okay. Alan.
You stepped on a piece of the network.
That's
now
right.
The spoilers are on your ass. Yeah.
That's right. They're gonna find and spoil you.
Mm-hmm.
Alan says, I believe so. We talked about the American Dreams. This is the prequel to the
comic,
the
right?
DLC Left Behind. This is the 4-issue comic book.
Mm-hmm.
Alan's got the details on this. Says, I believe there's only one official story publication for The Last of Us beyond the two games and the show, obviously, and it's the 4-issue comic book American Dreams published by Dark Horse. The reason I bring it up now is that comic is written by Neil Druckmann and is a story of Ellie arriving at the Boston Federal School and meeting and befriending Riley. It's written and published between the release of the main game and the Left Behind DLC. There's actually stuff in the comics that sort of contradicts the DLC, such as Ellie visiting the mall before and also meeting Marlene, that may render it non-canonical. That said, as a blueprint for the DLC, I find it kind of fascinating. So spoilers for the comic book. If you don't want that, then probably bail now, I suppose. But if you're like me and you've known about this comic for 10 years and haven't read it yet, stick around. Check it out. The episode this week clearly drew much from it. The scene where Ellie is told off by the school head teacher, Officer Guy, is taken straight from that comic. Ellie and Riley's prior relationship is expanded on in the comic. Ellie gets punched on her first day at school, and Riley in turn beats up the kid who attacked her. Ooh, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that Ellie has been in this school for a long, long time.
I would have thought so, too.
I guess it could have been years. Like, it could have been Ellie as a 5-year-old or something. But still, interesting. I've seen the comic, and I think that Ellie looks younger, but maybe like 12, not like younger like she's 6.
Mm-hmm.
I think they name her Carol in the episode, which... this is alluding to this first instance here.
Mm-hmm.
Riley also steals Ellie's Walkman, which she does in this episode. They establish a kind of antagonistic friendship in the comic, and Riley also goads Ellie into joining her and is sneaking through the mall. There's also a great page where Ellie imagines the arcade in its prime from the comic before the next panel shows it wrecked and strewn with bodies. It's clearly morphed into the arcade sequence in the DLC and episode. The comic also has a sort of vagrant character living in the mall called Winston, from whom Ellie and Riley steal a bottle of whiskey and radios in which to contact the Fireflies.
Hmm.
I wonder if this was the inspiration for the dead guy they loot in this episode. He also teaches Ellie.
Oh.
Big difference
yep.
in those verbs. To ride a horse, which she's thrilled by, which I guess they abandoned in the show's continuity. Well, I don't know. She rode that fucking horse in Jackson like a champ. I think this is interesting that he also had a lot of stuff about, I guess this comic goes into the Marlene of it all.
Oh,
maybe not into the aftermath, but into a little bit more information about how they met and how she knew her mother, which I cut out because those are, I think, spoilers for everybody, unless you've read the comic, which I imagine is very few of us. So I'm just going to, I think there's a chance that some of this stuff might come out in the next week or two, and we can just hold on American Dreams further spoilers until we get through this season. That's what I think.
Okay.
That's the only spoiler we have. We do have a few in the super spoiler section. We have about 3 emails to consider. So if you want to get out without knowing anything about The Last of Us 2, if you're waiting to play The Last of Us 2 at the end of the season, now would be a good time to get out. Flee for your lives. Okay, Dan T. from South Carolina. I'm wondering why Riley wouldn't be immune like Ellie. If it is a mutation in the runner who bit her that's the reason Ellie's immune and not her, then why isn't Riley immune too, since she was bitten by the same infected person? Wondering if there's a reason I'm missing. Enjoy your coverage. Keep up the excellent insights. Well, thank you. So that's true. We did mention last week that it's established, I believe in The Last of Us 2, that it's not something in Ellie that provides her immunity. It's a mutation in the fungus itself. If that fungus came from a single infected that bit them both, how the hell would you explain that, Jim?
I assume they're just, they react to it differently, right? It's, it, Ellie has an immunity to this particular evolution of the fungus, but Riley doesn't.
Yeah, they said this. I think they say that in biology that genes by themselves are meaningless, that they have to be expressed in an environment. You know, like you,
yeah,
you
like
know,
I might be allergic to pollen and you might not be, you know,
right? Right. So I think the way I understand it is it could be something that, like, yes, it's a mutation into fungus, but it would only express in certain type of people. Maybe it's a certain blood type. Maybe it's a certain immune system weakness or strength. Maybe it's a particular protein chain that resonates and you get the infection protection. So I think that checks out, but, you know, of course, in the real video game, they're attacked by a lot more than just one fucking runner. You know, it's like a, it's, it's a wave. So it's like it could be that, like, you know, they didn't get bit by the same. Maybe the game makes explicit they get bit by the exact same one, too. But the way I recall, it's not as clean as in this show. So I think we're covered either way. But that's the headcanon I'm rolling with. If you got any evolutionary biologists or fungologist, fungal researchers out there to want to say otherwise, hit me up, tlu@baldmove.com. Henry says, I want to point out the infected stuck in the wall suddenly waking up does in fact happen in the games. They show it a bunch in The Last of Us Part 2. When you come up on one, you're supposed to take it out with a silenced pistol or a crossbow before they wake up and attack you. I remember because they always startled the shit out of me. I'm also pretty sure the ones that have fungus sprouting out of their face, but not quite to the point that they lose their eyes, are what's known as stalkers in the game. They're different from other infected in that you can't see them in your listen mode, and they sneak around and use stealth as opposed to attacking head on. Could explain why this one took so long to attack them, and they couldn't hear them until it was right up on them. It's kind of a weak sauce spoiler, but it's like, you know, if you consider enemy unit types to be spoilers, I wanted to preserve that shock for you. I didn't remember the stalkers being walled up by the fungus.
No.
That could be, but, like, I just don't ever remember it. I remember them not because they're being, you know, like, the stalkers are exactly the same as a runner. It's just they have a different behavior pattern for some reason. The runners are always moving around shrieking. Even when they're not targeting a player, the stalkers just kind of stand in one place. And with the listening mechanics we talked about in The Last of Us, for you naughty, not game players that are listening to the spoiler section, if you it's because, like, it visualizes people, but they have to be generating noise, which means they have to be moving. If someone stays still for, like, up to 3 to 5 seconds, they disappear from that radar, which is why the stalkers are so dangerous.
A lot of them talk too, and you can hear that, but yeah, they disappear when they're not making noise.
Yeah. I didn't remember them being walled up as fungus, but, like, maybe enough people sent in this type of feedback that there must be at least one or two jump scares where they are.
Okay, yeah, I'll take your word for it. It's been a while since I played that game, and I don't remember that, but
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I hated the stalkers in the second game, man, because they essentially break the game mechanic where, like,
sure.
You know,
I think you're relying on not to get the shit scared out of you.
Man, when they're mixed in with clickers, it's like the fucking worst of all worlds.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't ever settle into a play style.
Mm-hmm.
David B. from our former hometown of Indianapolis says, during the scene where Joel and Ellie are sitting around the campfire and talking about what they're going to do after everything is done, Joel says he wants to live on a farm far away from everyone to raise sheep. That was definitely a spoiler for those who haven't played part 2 of the game, and possibly for the second season. I think to the last part of the second game with Ellie and Dina living together. Dina has her baby, and they're all living on a farm away from Jackson, raising sheep.
I do remember.
I think that's... I don't know that Joel ever talks about wanting to be a sheep farmer, but, like, I think that's a really cute way to weld both of those things in the game. And I'm sure it's going to pay off in season 2. I'm almost positive.
Mm-hmm.
Ian says, I'm enjoying your coverage of The Last of Us. Well, thanks, Ian. I was telling a friend who doesn't listen to the official podcast about how coy Neil was when he's talking about Ellie's scar and the 7-Eleven situation. So I was excited to hear you two also noticing his reluctance to get into details. Neil's tone answering this question makes me think this moment is a planned flashback or a dialogue bit in the rumored part 3 that he's been working on at Naughty Dog. May be fishing for validation of these rumors here, but it's curious that Neil doesn't even want to tell Craig how Ellie got her scar yet. Anyway, I wanted to run this by you guys since this exchange on the podcast stuck out to me the same way, or stuck out to you the same way it did to me. It could be. I guess the fact, because I remember thinking it's more of like maybe his personal embarrassment about the story. But I forgot that he does connect that this is going to be like Ellie, like this is something based on his life. And
does he? I couldn't remember if I was just like inferring that or imagining that.
Yeah, me too. And I didn't have time to like scan through the official podcast to see.
Yeah, but I think this is a good theory. I kind of like it that like they're working on a potential part 3 and he doesn't even want to tell Neil, or he doesn't even want to tell Craig because he doesn't quite know yet.
Yeah, like he's got the germ of the idea, but
would limit him, right?
If he says something to his creative partner on the show, then it becomes real, right?
Yeah,
and like what if he changes his mind, you're going to have this massive but Craig really likes that approach, you know. Also, if he doesn't watch out, Craig might get a story credit on the Last of Us 3 and
have to pay him $3 million. Yeah,
exactly. He ain't cutting out any pieces of that pie for nobody. Ryan is going to finish up for us today. Says Ellie's wandering alone at the end of part 2. Abby's still alive at the end of part 2 with an Ellie of her own. No story is complete without a part 3. How do you think Naughty Dog will end this epic saga? First time we've been asked, what do you think a loose outline for episode 3 would be?
Dude, I have no idea. A third person with their own Ellie? I don't know. That seems to be the pattern, I guess.
I think what, if I were Neil, I'd be tempted to do is synthesis. We had the story of Ellie and Joel murder hoboing their way across the United States, and Joel making the controversial decision to save Ellie at the potential expense of the entire human race. Second, we introduced the idea that other people have perspectives on those actions and can be ever bit as motivated to avenge their loved ones as Joel would be his brother or Ellie would be Joel, and what problems that makes for society. Third would be the synthesis of, essentially, I'm suggesting Ellie and Abby finding a way to coexist, literally, like in the same team, in the same town, burying the hatchet. And like they are the generation where this stuff ends.
Taking their mutual understanding of each other and creating a society around that.
Yeah. Yeah. But I don't know, because like, it's like just because you get to a point where you sing Kumbaya and you join hands doesn't mean the rest of the world is ready for it. So like,
oh, sure.
That's the Jackson conundrum. No matter how soft and squishy and ooey gooey things are in the middle, you have to have a hard protective shell or that society is just going to get its ass kicked in by the first person who is willing to lie or show aggression. Right.
I like it. I like it as a concept. Boy, what does that look like as a game though? Because you're not just going to be rebuilding a society as a game, right? That's not very.
It'd be exciting. Ellie and Abby having to go on a mission together for some reason. Like it'd be
okay, ending up on the quote unquote farm at the end of the game, right?
Yeah,
but this time it's a bigger farm with more people, and everything is happy.
Like maybe Ellie has to go on a mission to save Dina. Or I don't, because the thing is, it's not like Ellie, because if I recall correctly, in a T-Lu 2, Ellie goes back, like we don't know how it works out, but Ellie's going to go back to try to work things out with Dina, right? But Dina's left the house. She's gone back to Jackson, correct?
I think so. Like I said, don't remember it super well, but I think that's right.
So yeah, I was correct. Ellie goes back to the farmhouse, finds it empty, and then leaves the place. I always thought that she probably went back to Jackson to try to win Dina back. So in that circumstance, Abby has a lot better idea of where Ellie is than Ellie would of where Abby is going to go. So there'd have to be something where Abby needs Ellie to help on a mission. And then they run it. Man, that's hard for me to see. Trying to think, Abby going back to Ellie.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's the thing that makes the most sense. You'd have to come up with a good reason to put these two together. Because anything else, any other thing to explore that, you'd have to, you know, create entirely new characters and I don't know. Mm-hmm. But besides that synthesis of how you bury the hatchet and move on as a society, what else is there to explore?
Human nature and their inability to do what you just described.
I don't know. But, I'm always in fiction hoping someone points the way forward. Like, I was kind of secretly hoping in The Expanse that there would be some kind of grand, like, you know, if you any kind of long standing enmity that we face in the healing the trauma of colonialization and ending like racial and religious strife. And, you know, like, how do you do that? How do you do that when you've had systems where for generations people have been entrenched on sides and are blowing each other up and killing each other? I'm always hoping that there's going to be a fiction. It's like, this is the way. This is the plausible way. And like, they all seem to just point that as a huge problem. It's fantastically difficult to solve.
Sure. Almost something that's fundamental to being human.
Yeah, the closest I can come to like a mission state from The Expanse is probably the more powerful, stronger faction has to take a punch and not return it.
Totally.
Like, that's what I got. Like, someone has to decide that this provocation I'm not going to be provoked by. And it's probably going to be the stronger of the
and
two
they
kinda sides.
And they kind of have to be forced to. Right? Like the whole drummer situation. But
wasn't that the Churchill quote that the Americans can be relied upon after exhausting all their options to do the right thing? Like, there's that element of, you know, to kind of be led to the conclusion. So, like, that'd be an interesting thing for them to explore in the con. But honestly, man, I would have never guessed they would have gone to Last of Us 2 at the end of The Last of Us 1.
Fair, yeah.
I mean, who the hell saw that? Crazy. And like, that's so radical and out of the box and honestly antagonistic towards the player and your sensibilities that like a person that tells that story, who the fuck knows what they're going to be capable of.
Yeah, I do wonder if they'll try it again to do something that is just so subversive of what you think of as typical gameplay fun in a narrative.
Yes.
And reinvent video games again. That seems like a tall order, but I wouldn't put it past him.
I mean, he knows that, like, the player base he's got going into Last of Us 3 has got to be some kind of masochistic. So they're going to be willing to follow those, you know?
Or gaming experience junkies, right?
True, like, that too. Yeah.
You get this strange thing. Yeah, I want to experience that.
Because even if you don't like the plot of The Last of Us, the gameplay is excellent. It's extraordinarily fun and feels it's some of the best combat, like, you know, pulse pounding and exciting and cinematic that I've seen in a game.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I would love to hear your guys' thoughts. How do you predict something so unpredictable? TLU at baldmove.com. That's going to do it for this week.
It all
week's
takes
feedback.
Place in a 7-Eleven. How about that?
It turns out Ellie wakes up and she's on board a spaceship.
Oh, Jesus.
That's going to another solar system.
Abby and Ellie opened the Apocalypse's first 7-Eleven. It all takes place there. She loses part of her other eyebrow in the process.
They can never keep the slushy machine going.
It's a Slurpee, please.
Slurpee.
This is we didn't trademark this. We didn't spend money on the trademark for nothing, Aaron.
Is the 7-Elevens the Slurpees? Uh-huh, not a slushy? Uh-huh. Okay. Good for 7-Eleven. That's going to be it for the Slurpee trademarked sponsored edition of the Super Spoiler section and thus the feedback section. TLU at baldmove.com is how you follow us. If you want to get if you want to support us and get a whole bunch of bonus audio like our instant takes and talks, go to support.baldmove.com. And of course, there's twitter.com/baldmove at baldmove if you want to follow our other non The Last of Us releases. Find out what we're all about. Otherwise, thanks for making it to the end. Appreciate it. Hopefully, we'll see you on the Instant Take or Instant Talk this Sunday. But if not, we'll be back for the full podcast on Tuesday and another rip-roaring feedback section on Thursday. One last time, tlou@baldmove.com, TLOU@baldmove.com. Thanks again, everybody. We'll see you next time. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.